Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Garantz.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
I've missed you.
I've missed you too, Maya. We haven't recorded in like 3 weeks? You've been on vacation.
Okay, guys, I'm about to tell you something that's really important for you to know. If you're going to Europe, please check when your passport expires, because if your passport expires under three months, the EU will not let you in.
My husband's
passport was going to expire in 2.5 months. They would not let him get on the plane. And so I flew by myself to Barcelona with 2 children.
Oh, my God. What did he do? Did he just stay home, or was he able to get it?
He was able to join us a few days later, but we were leaving on a Friday afternoon, so the passport office just closed.
Oh, no.
So I took a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old to see Barca play at Camp Nou. They do not allow strollers.
Oh, my God.
I'm a very strong woman is what I'm trying to say.
That is, you are a strong woman.
I'll tell you what.
You know, you did great. That's awesome. Mm. And you saw Messi and Barca play live, so I'm very envious.
I had to see Messi play live at one, just once. It was really extraordinary. It was everything you would want it to be. It really was.
Wonderful. That's so great. Since Maya has been on vacation, a much needed and much deserved vacation, we have so much catching up to do.
Oh my God.
We've got a ton to talk about that's been happening over the past couple weeks. So bear with us, because we are going to be circling back to some stuff that's happened, like Stormy Daniels, and her entire interview in 60 Minutes and all of that stuff. And before we get to that, we just want to update on all kinds of topics that we've covered in the past, but that just always seem to keep popping back up.
I really feel like what we're trying to say is, you heard it here first. Like, you really did. Like, we keep talking about stuff
here first. Every time we talk about something, it seems like a day later, a week later, someone with a bigger platform is talking about it. And we're like,
we did that already.
We did that. In order to cover all this stuff, we're definitely going to need some drinks. So, Maya, what are you drinking right now?
I'm drinking just a rum and Coke. Just keeping it simple.
A classic.
Keeping it old school.
That's awesome. I'm having a sidecar with bourbon. A bourbon sidecar.
I love a bourbon sidecar. Oh, that's one of my favorite things. Oh, that's fantastic.
Oh, well, you got to come visit me sometime and I'll make you one. Because I must say, I did a pretty good job on this. I'm happy with it. So we're all set with our drinks. Let's talk about some topics. First thing I want to talk about comes really from a listener. Our listener reached out to us on Twitter. He's at PestoQuiche80s on Twitter. This was after we did a whole episode about how we think that this wave of teen activism, as personified by the teens from Parkland and that are part of the hashtag Never Again movement, we came up with this hypothesis that they were inspired by the YA literature they grew up reading, particularly Harry Potter and Harry Potter.
Yes.
Books.
Yes.
And we thought this was a really innovative theory. But PestoQuiche80s pointed out this article in Teen Vogue after the March for Our Lives that was basically like, kids at the march all had Harry Potter signs and were all explicitly basically saying, yes, we learned how to be activists from reading Harry Potter.
Yes. Yes. Basically every single sign. And we are the only people to get into it in a deep and meaningful way.
That's right.
Oh, God.
We delved. And we uncovered it.
We got experts. We uncovered it. We proved it. And then everybody else is just like following our lead.
I think
they don't even know
my
it.
Favorite one of these signs is the one that just says Expelliarmus, which is the disarming, to disarm your opponent's spell. So great job, teens, and great job, us.
Yeah, and great job, J.K. Rowling. Great job, writers of dystopian fiction that supports young people thinking that they can make a difference and fight evil.
Yeah.
Also, a while back, we did an amazing episode that I encourage all of you to go back and listen to, in which we talk about the deep sexism embedded in the 80s teen comedies of our lives.
Yes.
And all of the sort of sexual expectations and ideas about horniness that were embedded in those movies.
Yeah.
And what do you know? Molly Ringwald just this week writes a beautiful essay in The New Yorker about John Hughes and about rewatching all of her 80s movies that she did with him in light of Me Too and in light of these sort of changing expectations about inherited ideas of sex. And I was like, yes, Molly, mm-hmm. So glad you caught up with us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a really great essay and we recommend it. But yeah, we were there first. Let's yeah, be real.
We were there first, and we break it down in a really wonderful way. So I encourage you guys to all go back and listen to it. I also encourage everybody to go back and listen to the episode we did about Mother and Phantom Thread and all of the sort of big male genius filmmakers of our moment who all seem to be making movies mm-hmm. about their troubled relationships with women and muses and being geniuses. Jennifer Lawrence, who played one of these figures in the movie Mother, was dating Darren
Aronofsky,
was interviewed on WTF, and he asked, Marc Maron asked Jennifer Lawrence if she had seen Phantom Thread, and she's like, another movie about some like guy dealing with issues with his like female muse. She's like, been there, done that. Can't do it. I was like, thank you, girlfriend. We already got you covered. Exactly. So I highly recommend you all going back and listening to that episode as well.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to take the movie, The Phantom Thread, and just make a cut of it that just shows all the outfits and has no plot or dialogue, but I can just see all the outfits, I will watch that. Just putting that
Thank
out
you.
There.
Thank you. So also, I highly recommend all of you guys going back and listening to our incredible episode about the Mueller investigation as procedural drama, about the pleasures of the Mueller investigation, the narrative pleasures being connected to the procedural, because,
my goodness, is this one heating up? Yeah, so just this week, there was a huge development. Yeah,
yesterday,
as we are recording, there's a huge development where Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, had his home and offices raided by the FBI.
In a highly multi-location coordinated raid.
Yeah, which was a warrant sought by a Trump appointee and approved by a judge who's conservative as well. So just throwing that out there. So, not only is this exciting in and of itself, but it really does feel like in light of our analysis of the narrative pleasures of the Mueller investigation as related to police procedural, it makes me think of like, you know, the two-thirds of the way through the first season of The Wire.
When, 100%.
You know, when they've gathered all the evidence because they have to have probable cause if they're going to get the warrant, if they're going to be able to, you know, actually use the wire and
this is when the season has turned a corner. The season has turned a corner. And now we're in the last third where we're like diving towards it.
Yep.
Absolutely. And I do want to share regarding this. So my husband has done a lot of white collar criminal defense work. He's a lawyer and he's very skeptical. He's like, I think being a lawyer makes you very cautious. He's a true skeptic. He hasn't gotten too excited about a lot of the procedural developments that get me really excited because he's so like, he knows where things can go wrong. He knows the power of a good lawyer. So he's like, you know what? We'll see. I don't think they're going to do anything. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. The Michael Cohen raid, Ben was like, this is the first time I really am excited. This is actually very meaningful. And I said, well, Ben, wouldn't you worry about if they know that people might be coming for them, that they would destroy the evidence already? And he said that in itself is looks really, really, really bad. And yeah. So much stuff that you think you're deleting can be recovered. So this is also for all of you out there, just so you know, forensic analysts can recover all of your deleted shit.
Maya, we all watch procedurals. We know this. We all watch whatever, CSI. Yeah, and
so we are at the 2/3 of the way through the season turn. Mm-hmm. The event of the procedural. We are like starting to ramp up.
Getting really exciting. So we do need to do an update regarding the Me Too movement, because although we are somewhat weary of talking about it, it's a good thing that it continues. It continues and revelations continue to come out, and we should talk about some of the things that have happened over the past couple weeks.
Just little highlights, things that sort of pop out, because a lot of things have continued to be revealed, so much more than we could talk about. But a couple that have been kind of notable for us personally, where you really see the fissures.
Yes.
And you really see the cracks.
So the one that for me was incredibly resonant personally was John Kay. I'm going to mispronounce his last name, but I think it's Kricfalusi. He was the creator of Ren and Stimpy. And an article came out, I think on BuzzFeed, two women actually my age, not so young, but they had been young when they had interacted with him and were sexually exploited by him, sexually harassed as young aspiring cartoonists who had internships or jobs with him. They wrote to him as aspiring cartoonists asking how they could get started, and he, you know, brought them to at least one of them out to LA with this like, oh, you'll get an internship with me. And it turned into a sexual relationship while she was still underage. The reason this particular story like strikes home hard for me is I was a young teen in the early 90s who loved Ren and Stimpy. Like that was me. And I find myself thinking, well, thank goodness I didn't have the gumption and the wherewithal to write to my favorite creators. Thank goodness I didn't have that kind of drive or resourcefulness, that it didn't occur to me that I could write to someone whose work I admired and try to get an internship, which is a horrifying thing to think.
Ugh.
It's just, and it makes me think of, I mean, at that time I lived in San Diego, where, for, as you may know, if you're a regular listener, Maya and I grew up in San Diego. I went to San Diego Comic-Con every year. I would volunteer at Comic-Con. I would interact with vendors and creators and all kinds of professionals in the industry. And I knew from experience that every interaction is fraught in a way you don't want it to be. When you're a 16-year-old girl, the way men look at you, it's really like, I don't know, it brought a lot of that home, that feeling of like, hi, I just want to talk to you about being a comic book writer. Like,
right.
That's what I want to talk to you about. But I don't know what your motives really are. I don't know what you want from me. So it was really disturbing to me to think about these young ladies, like at least one of whom left the industry. And like, she has a great career in another field, but that is sort of the big theme of Me Too, from my perspective, is all of the creative women who didn't get a chance to make their cartoon, make their movie, write their book, whatever it is they were going to do, but they were essentially driven out of the industry by men like that.
And when you see the pictures, this guy was like in his 40s. Mm-hmm. And she looks like a child.
Oh,
I mean, she's like a 15, 16-year-old. She looks like a child. This guy was 40.
The picture included in the article is heartbreaking. And it's also like she even looks a little bit like me at that age. I don't know.
It's really heartbreaking. It really is like killing me. And the fact that all these people who worked with them, knew that he was dating an open secret. Children.
Absolutely. It was one of those open secret things. People absolutely knew. And beyond that, people knew he was an asshole to work with, and they knew he was a particular asshole to women. And that was just one of those, you know, there's whisper networks and women tell each other and everybody knew, don't work with this guy. What disturbs me so much is that it's not one bad seed. It's not one monster who is just a sensational story of awfulness. It's about an industry that is going to create the space for him to do that because he's making a cartoon people like.
That's right. So that was one story that really, I know for me, really stood out for me in terms of the continuing revelations that are happening with so many people. Another story that really stood out for me was the story that just came out about Tony Robbins.
Oh my God.
Tony Robbins, who's like self-help guru, was talking about how women who are participating in Me Too are just doing it for the attention, and that one of his business owner friends said that he didn't hire a beautiful woman because he was worried about harassment problems.
Yeah, can we even begin to unpack that? Oh my God. It also actually reminds me of another one of our faves, Brazil director.
Oh, Terry Gilliam.
Terry Gilliam.
Oh, stop it, man.
We didn't get a chance to talk about this, did we?
Oh, my God, we didn't. Oh, God, Terry Gilliam, stop.
Just shut up. Please just shut up. I'm just at this place where I'm like, you know what? Most of Terry Gilliam's movies are still good, and these guys being pieces of shit is rapidly becoming unacceptable, and that's what's important.
And Tarana Burke, who really started the Me Too movement, wrote an amazing response to Tony Robbins, because it's an 11-minute video of him physically intimidating this woman who's asking about Me Too. He's very aggressive, and he doesn't even understand the ways in which his physical aggression, in which he's performing the same aggression that she's trying to criticize. And he doesn't take the time to think, well, like, actually, maybe it's my problem. Maybe it's the problem of the men who are intimidated by beautiful women. And there is this thing that I just want to mention, where there were a few years ago, there were all of these very famous Buddhist leaders, Zen teachers, who were revealed to have been sexual harassers, exploiters. Mm-hmm. And one of the tricks that they would use is they would say that this kind of sexual harassment was a way to help break down the ego of their followers, because that's what we're supposed to be doing in this spiritualist movement, is to like
so gaslighting.
Down the, it's like amazing, right? But there's interesting, it's interesting that the sort of aggressive self-help, you can fix it, that it would be so hostile towards Me Too. And not surprising, but it's interesting. And it makes us have to interrogate even the language beneath. Like, that's, I think, something to maybe look into, the language beneath the sort of self-help, get better culture.
Yes, I think that would be an amazing topic. The whole culture, I think it's a very American thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
The culture around this idea that your destiny is always in your own hands, and the individualism implied in that.
And the individualist fantasy. So I think we're going to have to look at that, because, and I think we're going to have to finally break down the TED Talk, which I just fucking hate TED Talks. We're going to have to save that.
Future episode.
Okay. And finally, in terms of Me Too, I wanted to bring up something that's another layer of Me Too. I'm an artist, and one of the great art curators of our moment, a woman named Helen Molesworth, who is working as a curator at MoCA here in LA, got fired And she was being fired for undermining the museum, even though her two shows that she curated of African-American painter Carrie James Marshall and Brazilian artist Ana Maria Molino, who had never had a retrospective, were two of the most important shows to happen anywhere in America in the past year. But she was undermining the museum. And funny enough, two more female curators in the past 6 months have also been fired from their institutions. Laura Rakovich and Maria Inez Rodriguez from the Queens Museum and from the Museum of Contemporary Art in Bordeaux. And these women were too political. They were too demanding. They were undermining the museum. They were getting into fights with the board. So even women at the height of their career, of their power, even the ways that they're being criticized for not being good managers, men are never criticized in this way. They're not going to lose their jobs over this shit. These women are crazy talented. They're brilliant curators. They are making the culture by the shows that they say are important. And these three major figures have been fired. So it's a way of saying that even though Me Too is happening and all of these men are like, oh no, it's going to be so terrible for the world, the structure is still very much in place. And that's something that touched me, because these are the figures that I do want to see at the top of institutions. And they are having, even at the peak of their career, they are confronting these issues where they're undermining, they're political, they're demanding.
That's all I can say.
I know. Oh, God.
Giant sigh. A big thing happened while we were apart and not able to discuss it.
Oh.
We have to talk about Stormy Daniels.
Oh, my God.
Her interview on 60 Minutes, this whole situation is just fascinating. Okay, so, you know, we're always looking at things through this lens of culture and politics. So there's so much to talk about in that regard. The first thing I want to talk about is this question of, is Stormy Daniels' story a Me Too story? Because she claims that it's not a Me Too story. She went out of her way in the 60 Minutes interview to say, I am not a victim. I was not victimized. This is not part of that. And I am not claiming that.
Right.
But I think it definitely is a Me Too story. What do you think?
You know, it's hard to say, because this whole idea of, I knew what I was getting into and I knew what I had to offer and I knew what I was playing with. I think she makes it clear that part of sleeping with Trump was this idea that it was going to lead to something in terms of her career, that it was going to lead to her being on The Apprentice, that that was always the carrot that was being dangled.
Yes, so to speak.
so to speak. It's orange. It's,
yes,
you know,
yes.
And that after the first time they had sex, he was always explicitly dangling that carrot to give her to have sex with him again. And she didn't, and she wouldn't.
To me, that's the gist of it, right? He even there, she said he had her over to watch Shark Week, right? And prior to that, had been repeatedly saying, "Oh yeah, this is a done deal. You're going to be on The Apprentice. It's going to happen." She came over. They watched Shark Week, and she rebuffed his advances, and then it wasn't a done deal. And he was like, no, I couldn't get them to agree to put you on The Apprentice. Like, if that's not a Me Too story, I don't know what is. He wanted to have sex with her. And when she didn't, he took away the career opportunity.
Or that he would kept using this sort of dangling of the career opportunity to keep the relationship going. And once she stopped playing the game, so did he.
Yes.
And I feel like that, what she's saying is, I'm a willing player in the game.
Yes.
But I think the question is, isn't it a Me Too story if those are the games that you're going to be playing? If those are the choices at your disposal?
Exactly.
If you're a porn star and any way of being sort of a greater cultural figure is through this kind of sexual relationship, these are the choices at your disposal. And that's part of what the whole Me Too thing is about. It's about what we have available. for us. And maybe she's saying, I've accepted that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. And I think it bespeaks a large misunderstanding of what Me Too really is actually about. Because people think of it as being about victimization and about abuse. And right. You even hear it in some of the conversation around, like the comments that Matt Damon made. Some of the conversation around the idea that, oh, what Al Franken did wasn't so bad. It wasn't as bad as what Harvey Weinstein did. And this compare contrast thing, which implies that the essence of the movement is about the monstrous sexual abuses that men commit.
Right.
But in reality, it's about more than that, much more than that. And the real core of it is supposed to be about the workplace. And if you have to have sex with the guy to get that career advancement, even if you go into it as a willing participant and you understand the terms of the game, it's still the structure of the game that's the problem.
Yes, and the structure of the game that's set up for you to lose. And I keep thinking about the This American Life story about Don Hazen, about five women, how it talked about these two women who took very different approaches. One who was sort of complicit in playing the game of being the flirt with the boss, and one who refused to even engage in it.
Yep.
And that they both lost in different ways.
Yeah.
Because there is no way to win.
There's no winning in that game.
But I also think it's a Me Too story in the fact that, like, she was fucking physically threatened putting her kid in her car seat. Like, let's be for real. That's what makes it – that is also what makes it a Me Too story, that even by telling your story, we are going to physically threaten you. That has to be part of it.
I agree with that. And that gets us to another aspect of it that I wanted to talk about, which is – something you brought up, the way that she's playing upon a cultural trope, the sort of hooker with the heart of gold trope. You know, forgive my, I'm not calling sex workers hookers, but that's what's what we call the trope.
Yeah, that's the trope that she's playing into, or that she's being read through. And that's not about our feelings about people who do sex work. That's about a larger cultural story that gets told.
Yeah. And it occurred to me that if that story of her being approached by some thug, some goon, and being told, you know, you better not talk about Trump or else, if she hadn't had her kid in the car in that story, would it be the same story? It wouldn't. Like, it wouldn't.
It wouldn't.
And he even mentions, you know, he says that's a...
her family.
Yeah, he mentions her family and says it would be a shame if your pretty little daughter lost her mother or something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, Jesus.
But if the threat had simply been against her without any mention of the child, if there's no child in the car, if there's no, hey, look, I'm a mom, I'm a mommy trying to protect my kid, then it's a different story.
It is a different story, but there's also this other thing, which I think is the thing that stands out the most to me. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that has been so endlessly frustrating about Trump as a cultural figure is his way to kind of Teflon, not play by any of the fucking rules.
Right,
like, we are playing by the rules, and we are fucking sticking to the rules that you set for us. And God damn it, he seems to like...
No, he doesn't give a shit. Yeah.
He doesn't give a shit, and he seems to still win. That's the thing that's like, I could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and you're like, God, you know what? I think you could.
It's true.
And it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you do, because the game that he's playing is a different game. But Stormy Daniels has been playing that game. We have to talk about her and her trolling and her response to people. Part of what's so extraordinary about her, and I think that Hooker with a Heart of Gold gets folded into this, is her ongoing online performance about, like, fuck you, that's the worst you're gonna say about me, like, bring it on. Like, her tweets and her management, She is also not playing by the rules that are supposed to be the rules about being this kind of hooker. She's like, fuck you. Yeah, I'm a whore. What are you going to do? Oh, is that the worst you're going to say about me?
Yeah.
And the way that she keeps it going is fucking hilarious. It's like she's hilarious. She's in charge. It's almost like she's all we have against Trump because she's playing by his rules.
Yeah, it's true.
She's playing by his rules and she's winning.
Like the lawyer doing things like tweeting a picture of a CD or DVD in a safe. Like that's Trump quality trolling.
Performance, like getting the worst of the narrative. Like, oh yeah, you know, we got this.
Being a showman. What? Yeah.
Yes.
You're right. I agree. She has that down and she uses the fact of her being a sex worker, a porn star, to deflect what would ordinarily be the attacks on her.
Yes.
And it is interesting the way she's able to kind of negotiate those two personas that sort of like, I'm this like sassy, fuck you, I have sex on video and so what, versus, but I, you know, I'm just a mom and this guy threatened my kid. And I say that uncritically. I say that as flattery, like more power to her that she is playing on whatever cultural notions people have about sex workers.
Right. And there's a way in which there's this great article in The Wrap about how a porn industry beams with pride over Stormy Daniels' coup. We've never had anything like this.
I love that.
They're seeing this. They know that they're being, that sex workers are seen as the other, as the outside, as the most lowly, as something that cannot be gotten over. If you are a whore, you're a sex worker,
you're tainted.
You are dirty, you are wrong, you are deeply tainted. And she is so aggressively owning that perspective while speaking to herself and saying, this is still true. I can be whatever you fucking think of me, and he's still a fucking pig. And there's a way that it's almost like she has nothing that she's hypocritical about, and it makes her the perfect person to speak the fact that this is still his truth.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really extraordinary.
I think it's genius. I actually think it's brilliant that she did say that this isn't a Me Too story and that she's not a victim and that she was so out there and forefronting that. Because even though I disagree, and I do see her story in the context of Me Too, it was just so savvy for her to realize that that would create an avenue of attack against her. That if you claim to have been victimized in some way, it's like she's choosing very carefully where to allow Trump to have power in this narrative and where not to, where to show him abusing his power and where to not be making that claim.
It's incredibly savvy, but also when you say, like, she is in some ways winning because she's doing it for the clicks.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where she's playing Trump at his game and winning.
Oh, yeah.
Is that she's winning at the game of getting the most clicks, the most attention, the most laughs. Mm-hmm. She's winning the joke.
Yes.
It's really something to see.
Yeah. And I especially love when she tells about having sex with him. She told 60 Minutes, you know, she went to his hotel room. There was some interaction that was awkward. But then he loosened up when she called his bullshit and he talked. It was fine.
When she spanked him.
That's correct.
Mm.
She said she came out of the bathroom and he was sitting there perched on the edge of the bed and she knew what he wanted. And she says, you know, I'm a grown up. I came to his hotel room. I knew what I was getting into. Like she's very clear, but it gives her the opportunity to cast Trump as the guy that is sexually unappealing.
Yes.
I didn't want him, but I knew what I was getting into, so I had to. Like that, if there's anything that hits at the heart of Trump's ego and
is that he was sexually unappealing. He was a shitty lay.
Yeah.
I was offered because I thought I was going to get something out of it. I didn't, so I super didn't fuck again. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And actually, I have to say that I'm surprised that more men aren't worried about that. Like, do you think that your power and your money and that this is what you're going to use to manipulate women into having sex with you, it makes you a shitty lay? Do you want to be a shitty lay? Like, do you really want to be the guy who women only fuck because you're like powerful and successful? Like, wouldn't you rather actually be sexually appealing and somebody that women would want to fuck? Like, that to me is kind of an unspoken conversation that I feel like I need to see more men having.
I feel like there's two different things you're talking about here, right? Because being a great lay and being hot are two different things.
Mm.
So I think that for men, their ideal situation for straight men is that they would be wealthy and powerful enough that women just want to have sex with them, but they should also be hot enough that women just want to have sex with them. That's your ideal. But if you can't meet that ideal of being attractive to women physically and also wealthy and powerful, you can have one or the other, you know? And I honestly think there's no shame for dudes in being able to be like, yeah, I'm fat and disgusting, but women fuck me all the time because I'm powerful. Like, you're still winning in that scheme of masculine competition against each other.
Right.
And the women's satisfaction in the picture does not rate. Like, that's not part of the story. Being able to satisfy women, in fact, it's probably better in the scheme of masculine competition if you don't give a shit whether the women get off or not. However, that said, Trump specifically is such a narcissistic egotist that he has to be the best at everything. Like, this is a person who boasted about his penis size in a televised political debate.
Right.
Like, he cannot let any criticism of him go unchallenged. It doesn't matter what it is. So maybe for a Harvey Weinstein or similar type of guy, it doesn't matter if you're like, ooh, he was gross, I didn't want to have sex with him. But for Trump, it matters. It absolutely matters. He cannot let that stand.
And it's so like, oh God, the way that she talks about fucking him is so supremely dismissive. It's something. It's really beautiful.
No, it's beautiful. Stormy, keep up the good work.
We love you. We love you, Stormy. We're loving it. We are so appreciating. You're playing him at his game and you're fucking winning. It's really something. Mm.
It's time for the drunk-o-meter, Maya. Here's where we rate how drunk we are on a scale of 1 to 10 with one sentence of explanation. You want to go first?
You know, if I could just be like this, I think I could really manage functional alcoholism. I'm at a good 5, but if there's a clarity to it, which is the hard booze drunk, this is a nice functional alcoholism 5.
That's a great place to be. I love that. I love that level. I'm similar, maybe not so much clarity, because there's definitely simple syrup in my drink. That fucks everything up.
Sugar will really get you.
It gets you, right? Sugar, it's the killer. But I mean, I would say I'm at like a 4.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I'm moving along.
You know, at some point, I really wonder about when we're going to really get to 7 or an 8.
We'd have to put in some effort.
We'd really have to.
We might have to pregame to make that happen.
We have to both pregame, and then I have to make sure that I have childcare on the other side of that. Like,
exactly.
Fucking hangover.
Gotta clear the evening.
Gotta clear
it out. All right. So we would love to hear from you, listeners. We want to know your thoughts about Stormy Daniels and her approach to this whole situation, or any of the other topics we've talked about. Also, what topics would you like us to talk about in future episodes? Because we love to break shit down and analyze the underlying cultural narratives that motivate all the things that are going on in pop culture.
Yes.
You can write to us at saucepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at saucepodcast. You can find us on iTunes, where you can not only listen, but also rate and review us. Please do. We don't have that much ratings. You can also find me, Rebecca. I am on Twitter at Gynostar. I'm also on Instagram, the same name. And you can find my comics at gynostar.com. Maya, where can people find you?
Maya Garance everywhere.
Spell it for them, because it's not completely obvious.
Okay, fine. I think it's pretty obvious. It's MayaGuranTz. And you can find me on Twitter, on Instagram, at gmail.com. You can find me. If you want me, you can find me.
So when you go to get a Gmail or Twitter handle or website, you just put in Maya Garance and they're like, fine.
Yeah, because there are That's no fine. Others. There are no others.
Yeah, there's no others. That's like the opposite of me.
Yeah, I don't try to be an alternate, you know, human personality. It's like, this is who the fuck I am, and that's it. That's all I got.
Hey, I'm not hiding, but you try to get any Rebecca Cohen handle,
that's
okay?
True. That's true.
You have to be the first person on the platform. All right, listeners, until next time, adios, amoebas.